curious that a cardinal feature of the Buddha's doctrine is that craving is the root of suffering. But craving, going further back to another root, which is ignorance, avidya in Sanskrit, means lack of vision. Video in Latin is I see, and that's related back to the Sanskrit vidya. Avidya, unseeing, unconsciousness, lies behind craving, and this in its turn lies behind suffering. And of course, when we in the West first heard about this, we interpreted the idea in a very crude way, which is this, that all one's disappointments are the result of frustrated desire. But it's a very much more subtle point of view than that. To understand Buddhism in any case, you must realize that it is not something like a teaching, as we ordinarily understand a system of teaching. It isn't simply a way, as we have in our universities, of a teacher imparting you certain authoritative information, which when you've heard it, you've got the message. It's a dialogue. It's a situation in which the teacher doesn't really have anything to tell you. He's simply reacting to your own bringing up of problems. And it's as if people came to the Buddha and said, "Sir, we suffer terribly. And what are we going to do about that?" And he replies, "Is it not true that you suffer because you desire?" They said, "Well, maybe that makes sense." "All right," he said, "see if you can do without desire." And all those students go away and see if they can calm their desires. They come back and say, "This is pretty difficult, because we are animal beings and we have all these appetites to begin with. And then beyond that, we're in the unfortunate position of being aware of time, being aware of the future. And although it's advantageous to know about the future, in the long run it's depressing, because we all know that we come to a bad end, and that there everything falls apart in time. That would be especially true if you lived under the influence of Indian cosmology, where the world is regarded as a process that begins beautifully, but as it goes on, gets worse and worse till it destroys itself. And then there's a long period of rest, and it starts out again, beginning beautifully, but getting worse and worse all the time. Everything runs down in time according to that cosmology. And so there seems to be a fundamental futility. Desire for whatever it is that you want. But behind this, the intention of studying desire, seeing whether one can discipline desire, whether one can curb it, is a deeper question altogether, which is, what do you desire? What makes you itch? What sort of a situation would you like? Let's suppose, I do this often in vocational guidance of students. They come to me and say, "Well, we're getting out of college and we haven't the faintest idea what we want to do." So I always ask the question, "What would you like to do if money were no object? How would you really enjoy spending your life?" "Well, it's so amazing. As a result of our kind of educational system, crowds of students say, 'Well, we'd like to be painters, we'd like to be poets, we'd like to be writers, but as everybody knows, you can't earn any money that way.'" Or another person says, "Well, I'd like to live an out-of-doors life and ride horses." I say, "Do you want to teach in a riding school? Let's go through with it. What do you want to do?" When we finally got down to something which the individual says he really wants to do, I will say to him, "You do that. And forget the money." Because if you say that getting the money is the most important thing, You will spend your life completely wasting your time. You'll be doing things you don't like doing in order to go on living, that is, to go on doing things you don't like doing, which is stupid. Better to have a short life that is full of what you like doing than a long life spent in a miserable way. And after all, if you do really like what you're doing, it doesn't matter what it is, you can eventually turn it, you could eventually become a master of it. It's the only way to become a master of something, to be really with it. And then you'll be able to get a good fee for whatever it is. So don't worry too much. Somebody's interested in everything. And anything you can be interested in, you'll find others who are. But it's absolutely stupid to spend your time doing things you don't like in order to go on spending things you don't like, doing things you don't like, and to teach your children to follow in the same track. See, what we're doing is we're bringing up children and educating them to live the same sort of lives we're living, in order that they may justify themselves and find satisfaction in life by bringing up their children, to bring up their children to do the same thing, so it's all wretch and no vomit. It never gets there. And so, therefore, it's so important to consider this question: what do I desire? Well, when we answer that question in a naive way, we figure out that we want a desire, what we want is to control everything. To create girls that don't grow old, apples that don't rot, clothes that never wear out, conveyances that get from one place to another instantly so we don't have to wait, power available to do anything that you could conceive and do it just instantly like that. To get this funny technological omnipotence. But if you take time out to think about that and really go into it with your full strength of imagination and find out whether that's where you want to be, you will soon see that's not what you want. Because the moment you have a situation where you are really in control of things, that is to say, in which the future is almost completely predictable. You will see, as I said last night, that a completely predictable future is already the past. You've had it. And that's not what you wanted. You want a surprise. And you don't know what that's going to be, because obviously it wouldn't be a surprise if you did. You want a pleasant surprise. But like you say, what sort of a surprise would be pleasant? And you can't really answer that. Because you know, if there are to be such things as pleasant surprises, there must also be unpleasant surprises. There must be rude shocks. So you're like somebody taking one of those wishing well boxes, you know, tubs, you know, where you fish in and you bring out a package. And you don't know whether you've got a dead rat in it or a new camera. And that's the way, that seems to be the thing that really excites people. But quite certainly there comes out of this inquiry a feeling of real disillusionment with the ideal of power. To be in power, to be in control, is not something that any sensible person wants. Imagine the situation of Big Brother. Mr. J. Edgar Hoover, Heinrich Himmler, to be glued day and night to a highly defended office with telephones, television screens, watching, peeking, spying on everyone and anything, getting all this information together. Why? You could never leave the office. I mean, the character, I suppose, like J. Edgar Hoover, goes home in the evening, and but when he's back home, you know, there are guards sitting outside the door, there's that hotline telephone going to something, he's always having to be in control. And he can't take any time off, he can't go for a walk in the park with a friend, or go innocently to the movies, or sit down and just relax and have an undistracted party in the baths at Big Sur. You know, what a pauper this guy is. Completely deprived. Because he wants to be in control, because he wants power. People are frustrated in love. If you're jilted, there's a natural tendency in a human being to seek power as a substitute. And that's a very negative thing. It's like having a bad temper. To seek power after you're frustrated in love, you should try and get back on the love beam. Because nobody wants power. Now, you may say that's shirking responsibility. That if you were a really responsible person, you would go out for power and try to use power to the best possible advantage for the benefit of all. All right, what would be the benefit of all? Ask them. What do you want me to do with this power? I'm dictator. What would you like me to do? Well, nobody knows, because they haven't thought it through. They think of all sorts of short-range things, and they are largely conflicting and confusing, because they're not well thought out. But again, when it finally comes down to it, nobody wants to be God. Now then, when Oriental philosophy and religion was first introduced to the Western world, it was introduced under the auspices of people who were fascinated with power. It was introduced in the latter part of the 19th century, when we had heard all about evolution and how the human race was going on to ever greater heights, and we would eventually develop Superman, according to Nietzsche or D.B. Shaw, and H.G. Wells. Remember, all that early fantasy of where evolution would lead through the development of technology. And so at this time, people like H.P. Blavatsky were talking about the mysterious wisdom of the East. And they phrased it, they commended it to us in a technological spirit. That there was psychic technology. That there was something that you could go way beyond anything that could be done through the physical sciences. You could cause your physical body to disintegrate to another level of vibration and then transmit it and reassemble it somewhere else. You could live as long as you liked because you control the fundamental processes. You could determine if you decided to die where you would be reborn, exactly. You would be a complete master of life. And so there are still innumerable books being sold which present Oriental philosophy and religion in this light. That charlatan Lobsang Rampa, who writes about Tibetan mastery. People read that because they think that there may be a way of beating the game. So therefore, the wise men of Asia were represented through this kind of propaganda as masters of life, as, for example, people whose emotions didn't bother them, who could put up with any amount of pain by simply turning off their feelings, who could foretell the future, who could read your thoughts, and who were above all kinds of ordinary human frailty. Well, when I first met Buddhist priests, Zen masters, swamis, all these wise men from the East, one of the first things that impressed itself upon me was that they were perfectly ordinary human beings. They had bad tempers. They were fussy about certain things. They just acted as I would expect human beings to act. And so at first I was very disappointed. I thought they had feet of clay, that they didn't come up to these promises of psychotechnology. But after a while, I got to realize why not, that they had already thought all that through. They had thought through what might be done if one had all these powers. and had decided that wasn't what they wanted. The powers of this kind in Sanskrit are called siddhi, S-I-D-D-H-I. But there is hardly one decent scripture or text on yoga that does not say again and again, if you get siddhi, ignore them. Go on to something else. These are only the foothills. These are, furthermore, not only foothills, but they are seductive, blind alleys. Won't take you anywhere at all. Now, I think that this is the greatest possible lesson for the Western world to learn, because we are so hung up on the idea of power, of control, of being able to make everything go the right way, and if we've never thought it through. When you get control of it, what are you going to do with it? Supposing I have, I'm an alchemist, and I have a whole secret closet full of love filters, very potent ones. And if I see a desirable woman, all I have to do is to offer her a cigarette or give her a glass of wine with one of my secret potions in it. And instantly, I'm her master. Now, what, when I think that through, what would I do with a situation like that? Because all I've got again is that plastic doll that when I push it, it does what I tell it to and doesn't have any comeback. What you always are looking for in things is where the surprise is there, where there's a comeback. And you say, my God, this thing is alive. It has a will of its own. It is not in my control. And I would like to have a relationship with something like that, because it would never be dull. And also, you would feel true affection. After all, you can make love to yourself in a mirror. You can have one of those Dutch wives. You buy them in a place in Kobe, where you get these rubber girls that you fill with hot water. And sailors take them on long voyages. But what an awful thing, you know, when you realize that this thing has no gear, no surprise in it, no thing that it does on its own, you see. And so when you think things through like that, you understand you do not want power. You don't want to control everything. And therefore, these Zen Buddhist masters that I met and others were not super occultists. And very many Westerners who visited Japan expecting to get a Satori as a result of which they would know everything and control everything were grievously disappointed and said there's not much in this after all. So therefore, from the standpoint of Buddhism, the fact that the power game is not the game is expressed by saying a Buddha is one who has gone beyond the gods. Because the gods have power. The Buddhism imagines all kinds of levels of heaven worlds inhabited by all kinds of gods. And the supreme of all the gods is called Ishvara. But it is said that all those gods in their paradisal worlds are in samsara. They're in the round of birth and death. And what goes up must come down. They're immensely successful. They're at the peak of power, spiritual power. But they're not delivered yet, because they still don't know what they want. And therefore, in the exploration of what you want, you get to the point where having all pleasures at your command, and they pall, and you think of new sources of pleasure. And eventually you get like the ancient Romans, who had all these mad crowds of barbarians who had to go every Saturday to the Colosseum for a show that really had to surpass everything. Because they had public baths, they had prostitutes, they had every kind of luxury. But when they went to see one of the big shows that people like Nero put on. They would have, for example, floats circling the Colosseum, all full of slave girls from distant parts of the Mediterranean, garlanded with flowers and waving at the crowd and going innocently around. And the next minute they would release wild lions into the arena to eat up all the slave girls. And they got a big sadistic kick out of that. Because you see, pursuing pleasure beyond a certain place takes you into what the Buddhists call the Naraka world, that is to say, the hells. When you have explored pleasure to its ultimate limit, the only thing you can get a kick out of is pain. So naturally, you descend from the Deva world at the top of the wheel to the Naraka world at the bottom, where it shows all these beings in states of torture. Now, of course, the priests say, when they're bringing up children, if you do bad things, you will end up in the hell world. But this is a very inadequate way of showing how one gets to the hell world. You get to the hell world as a result of not knowing what you want. As a result of thoughtless pursuit of pleasure, which ends you eventually in the pursuit of pain. So when you're in the hell world, that's where you want to be. So then the question is, to clarify once more, what do we want? If you understand, first of all, that you don't want absolute power, you don't want absolute control. You want, yes, some control. You see, we always love controlling something that's not really under our control. Remember, I gave you the illustration right in the beginning of holding a gyroscopic top and feeling sometimes you're with it, but sometimes it's alive under your hand. And this sensation, too, you often get, say, in driving a car or something like that. It's more or less under your control, but on the other hand, it isn't. And that's the beautiful thing, because when something is partly under your control, but isn't, then you have the same sort of relationship with it that you have when you have someone you love, some other person. They are partly under your control because they've agreed to live with you and go along with you and so on, but also they're not. And the measure to which they're not is the measure to which they seem really alive to you. So then, we ask the question, if the motivation of power gaining disappears, you've seen through it and you know that's not what you want, what other motivation takes its place as the origin of actions? And it seems to me that the answer here is compassion. Simply because when you want to relate to another living being, what you really are asking of them is that they be in the same situation that you are. You want to meet and encounter someone else who has your problems, your fears, and your delights. You don't want a doll. You want another you, another self. Because that would be at least as surprising to you as you are. And so then at once, that when you see that is the case, and that the most interesting thing in the world is the relationship with these others, and you can see at once yourself in the situation of all the other people, And then you think, no, I don't want to control these people. I would like them, yes, to be controlled in the sense that they were happy to do the things I would like them to do. But obviously I can't force that, because if I forced it, they wouldn't be happy. See, when you marry someone, when you have a family, you want your children, you want your relatives, you want your wife, etc., to be happy to do the things for you that they do. And so we say to each other, would you like to bring the washing in? And very often the answer is no, but I will. Because you see, we put it that way, because we always hope that the things that we do for each other will be pleasurable to both sides. So a school teacher will get up in class and says, what nice boy will clean the blackboard for me? All these ways we use of trying to get voluntary cooperation, willingly given help, that's what we look for. But there is, despite the lot of foolishness that goes on, this is a sound thing, you see, that there really is no greater satisfaction that you can imagine than that kind of personal relationship wherein you can trust a being who is other than you and not under your control to do for you what you want, because they like it. As you, on your side, would want to do something for them in that way, and so as to give pleasure to the other person. Let's take in sexuality, where you get a kind of a critical example of this. The biggest fun in sexual relationships is giving orgasm to women. And if that doesn't happen, many men feel disappointed. Because the thing that they really wanted to do was to give pleasure and get their own pleasure out of giving it. Now that's compassion. In the real sense of the word, feeling with and through someone else. Where the whole trick is that you lose control for a while of the situation and say, I throw the ball to you, now it's yours. Now I may seem, therefore, as a result of talking in this way, to be talking like a Jewish or a Christian theologian. Because that's what they say about God. That God did something called kenosis in the beginning of all time. Kenosis is a Greek word meaning self-emptying, self-sacrifice, giving up, and thereby conferred freedom of will and the power to love on angels and human beings. And therefore took a terrific risk by trusting the other. By trusting a principle called other that's not under your control. Oh, with God, of course, it is ultimately under his control, but he sits back and smokes a cigar sometimes and lets it go. See what the children will do. You know, like DeLorme in Green Pastures, a big cigar. but you see, it's really, in a way, the same idea as the Hindu idea. When the Christian speaks of God giving the creature freedom of will, the Hindu says, no, God gets lost in that person and gives up power and it's really the same thing. It's the idea that the all-powerful surrenders power so that the more you give the power away, what you're really doing is you're othering yourself. Now, the more you other yourself, by giving power away, the more of a self you are. Because self and other are reciprocal. So you find that people who through a sadhana, a yoga discipline, have overcome their ego, have transcended the ego, are tremendously strong personalities. You would think, theoretically, they would all be non-entities. And to lack entirely what psychologists call ego strength. But actually, they're nothing of the kind. They are, every one of them, unique. They're all quite different from each other. And they are very, very, what I would call strong characters. Because the more they have given it up, the more they get it. So, in this way of thinking, let's put it in another dimension for the moment. Let's suppose we are thinking of a relationship that is not just to people. People are very obviously other and independent of one's ego. But give it to everything. Say to everything, which in course is going to include as much of yourself as you can objectivize. In other words, your stomach, your intestines, your everything, see? Say to it all, now it's your turn. Let's see what you're going to do. Let it happen. You know, you do this complete let off of control. And you find that I have to put it in a provisional way first. You get the sensation that that everything else is living you. It lives you. That you've given away control, you see, to everything else. It's a lovely, irresponsible state to be in.